When Langdon had left the Vatican secret archives only 2 hours ago, he had never imagined he would see them again. Now, winded from having jogged the entire way with his Swiss Guard escort, Langdon found himself back at the archives once again. His escort, the scarred guard, now led Langdon through the rows of translucent cubicles. The silence of the archives felt somehow more forbidding now, and Langdon was thankful when the guard broke it. "Over here, I think," he said, escorting Langdon to the back of the chamber where a series of smaller vaults lined the wall. The guard scanned the titles on the vaults and motioned to one of them. "Yes, here it is, right where the commander said it would be." Langdon read the title. Attivi Vaticani. Vatican assets. Well, why not? In Bernini's day, everything an artist created while under the patronage of the Pope became, by law, property of the Vatican. Langdon walked to the vault's electronic revolving door. The guard didn't follow. "My orders are to escort you here, and then return immediately to the security center." "You're leaving?" Langdon was appalled. "Yes. When you find what you're looking for, contact the commander immediately." "But where will he be?" Langdon asked. The guard removed his walkie-talkie and set it on a nearby table. "Channel one." Then he disappeared into the dark. The television in the office of the Pope was an oversized Hitachi, hidden in a recessed cabinet opposite his desk. The doors to the cabinet were now open, and everyone gathered around. As the screen warmed up, a young female reporter came into view, a doe-eyed brunette. "For MSNBC News," she announced, "this is Kelly Horan Jones, live from Vatican City." The image behind her was a night shot of St. Peter's Basilica with all its lights blazing. "You're not live," Rocher snapped. "That's stock footage. The lights in the basilica are out." Olivetti silenced him with a hiss. The reporter continued, sounding tense. "Shocking developments in the Vatican elections this evening. We have reports that two members of the College of Cardinals have been brutally murdered in Rome." Olivetti swore under his breath. As the reporter continued, a guard appeared at the door, breathless. "Commander, the central switchboard reports every line lit. They're requesting our official position on..." "Disconnect it," Olivetti said, never taking his eyes from the TV. The guard ran off. Vittoria sensed the Camerlengo had wanted to say something, but had stopped himself. Instead, the man stared long and hard at Olivetti before turning back to the television. MSNBC was now running tape. The Swiss guards carried the body of Cardinal Ebner down the stairs outside Santa Maria del Popolo and lifted him into an Alfa Romeo. "Who the hell shot this footage?" Olivetti demanded. The MSNBC reporter kept talking. "This is believed to be the body of Cardinal Ebner of Frankfurt, Germany. The men removing his body from the church are believed to be Vatican Swiss Guard. And this just in." The shot that filled the screen was of a couple in St. Peter's Square moving through the crowd. Vittoria instantly recognized the two people as Robert and herself. In the corner of the screen was a text overlay, courtesy of the BBC. A bell was tolling. "Oh, no," Vittoria said aloud. "Oh, no." The reporter was still talking, her eyebrows furrowing with intensity. "Although MSNBC has yet to confirm a motive for the attack, our sources tell us that responsibility for the murders has been claimed by a group calling themselves the Illuminati." Olivetti exploded. "What?" "Find out more about the Illuminati by visiting our website at..."
"Non è possibile," Olivetti declared.
He switched channels.
"A satanic cult known as the Illuminati, who some historians believe..."
Olivetti began pressing the remote wildly. Every channel was in the middle of a live update. Most were in English. Vittoria turned away. Everything was happening so fast. Outside the window, in the settling dark, the raw magnetism of human tragedy seemed to be sucking people toward Vatican City. The crowd in the square thickened almost by the instant.
"It appears," the Camerlengo said finally, sounding too devastated to be angry, "that we have not contained this crisis as well as I was led to believe."
He looked out the window at the gathering masses.
"I need to make an address."
Olivetti shook his head.
"No, signori. That is exactly what the Illuminati want you to do. Confirm them. Empower them. We must remain silent."
Rocher shouted suddenly, grabbing the remote and increasing the volume on the television. Everyone turned. On air, the woman from MSNBC now looked genuinely unnerved. Superimposed beside her was a photo of the late Pope.
"Breaking information. This just in from the BBC. The Illuminati have just claimed responsibility for..." She hesitated. "They have claimed responsibility for the death of the Pope 15 days ago."
Olivetti erupted.
"Madness! A bold-faced lie!"
Rocher began flipping channels again. The bulletin seemed to spread like a plague from station to station. As Rocher flipped, he passed a BBC station.
"Tipped me off about the killing at Santa Maria del Popolo."
"Wait,"
the Camerlengo said.
"Back!"
Rocher went back. On screen, a prim-looking man sat at a BBC news desk. Superimposed over his shoulder was a still snapshot of an odd-looking man with a red beard. Underneath his photo, it said, "Gunther Glick, live in Vatican City."
"Let me reiterate for our viewers," the anchorman in London was saying.
"BBC reporter Gunther Glick is the man who first broke this story. He has been in phone contact twice now with the alleged Illuminati assassin. Gunther, you say the assassin phoned only moments ago to pass along a message from the Illuminati?"
"He did."
"And their message was that the Illuminati was somehow responsible for the Pope's death?"
The anchorman sounded incredulous.
"Correct. The caller told me that the Pope's death was not a stroke, as the Vatican had thought, but rather that the Pope had been poisoned by the Illuminati. He gave no specifics, except to say that they killed him with a drug known as..."
There was a rustling of papers on the line.
"Something known as heparin."
"Heparin?" Rocher demanded, looking unnerved.
"But isn't that..."
The Camerlengo blanched.
"The Pope's medication."
Vittoria was stunned.
"The Pope was on heparin?"
"He had thrombophlebitis," the Camerlengo said. "But heparin isn't a poison. Why would the Illuminati claim..."
"Heparin is lethal in the wrong doses," Vittoria offered. "It's a powerful anticoagulant. An overdose would cause massive internal bleeding and brain hemorrhages, symptoms easily mistaken for a stroke, especially in the absence of a proper autopsy."
Olivetti eyed her suspiciously. "How would you know that?"
"Marine biologists use it on sea mammals," Vittoria said, "to prevent blood clotting from decreased activity."
The Camerlengo now looked deeply troubled. Vittoria turned to him.
"If he overdosed with heparin," she said, "his body would show signs. Overdoses cause bleeding of the oral mucosa. Post-mortem, the blood congeals and turns the inside of the mouth black."
The Camerlengo swung into action. First, he singled out two guards.
"I want the BBC reporter, Mr. Glick, in this office immediately. Go."
The two soldiers disappeared. Next, the Camerlengo turned and addressed the remaining guards.
"Gentlemen, I will not permit any more loss of life this evening. By 10 o'clock, you will locate the remaining two cardinals and capture the monster responsible for these murders. Do I make myself understood?"
"But, signore," Olivetti argued, "we have no idea where..."
"Mr. Langdon is working on that. He seems capable. I have faith."
With that, the Camerlengo strode for the door, a new determination in his step. On his way out, he pointed to three guards.
"You three, come with me. Now."
The guards followed. In the doorway, the Camerlengo stopped. He turned to Vittoria.
"Miss Vetra, you too, please,
Come with me.
At CERN, in Leonardo Vetra's frigid apartment, Maximilian Kohler had finished reading the leather-bound journal he'd taken from Vetra's bedside table. Now he was watching the television reports. After a few minutes, he replaced Vetra's journal, turned off the television, and left the apartment. Far away, in Vatican City, Cardinal Mortati carried another tray of ballots to the Sistine Chapel chimney. He burned them, and the smoke was black. Two ballotings, no pope. Flashlights were no match for the voluminous blackness of St. Peter's Basilica. As if sensing her discomfort, the Camerlengo dropped back and laid a hand on Vittoria's shoulder. I'm sure you never expected to find yourself among the tombs and the Vatican grottos. Vittoria shook her head. Then something occurred to her. When did you hear your call? She asked him. Before I was born. Vittoria looked at him. I'm sorry. I mean from the moment I could first think. The Camerlengo paused, looking at her. Miss Vetra, thank you for your help here today. I am very sorry about your father. Truly. Thank you. I never knew my father. He died before I was born. I lost my mother when I was 10. Vittoria looked up. You were orphaned? She felt a sudden kinship. I survived an accident that took my mother. Who took care of you? God, the Camerlengo said. He quite literally sent me another father. A bishop from Palermo appeared at my hospital bed and took me in. I worked under the bishop's tutelage for many years. He eventually became a cardinal. Still, he never forgot me. He is the father I remember. The group arrived beneath a towering pillar, and their lights converged on an opening in the floor. Vittoria looked down at the staircase descending into the void and suddenly wanted to turn back. The guards were already helping the Camerlengo onto the stairs. They helped her next. What became of him? She asked, descending, trying to keep her voice steady. The cardinal who took you in. He left the College of Cardinals for another position. And then, I'm sorry to say, he passed on. Le mie condoglianze, Vittoria said. Recently? The Camerlengo turned, shadows accentuating the pain on his face. Exactly 15 days ago. We are going to see him right now. Inside the archival vault, Langdon quickly located the section of assets containing the ledgers cataloging Belle Arti. It took him 2 minutes to find the ledger marked Bernini. It was over 5 inches thick. Like a kid with a new comic book, he spread himself out on the floor and opened the cover. He spent a minute or two flipping randomly through the ledger in hopes that an illustration might jump out at him. Nothing did. Reluctantly, he decided, against his better judgment, to take the book outside the vault. It's only a ledger, he told himself. It's not like I'm removing an original Galilean folio. Langdon recalled the folio in his breast pocket and reminded himself to return it before leaving. Hurrying now, he returned to the beginning of the volume, but as he did, he saw something that gave him pause. There was a note that indicated that the famous Bernini sculpture, The Ecstasy of St. Teresa, shortly after its unveiling, had been moved from its original location inside the Vatican to some obscure chapel across town. Per suggerimento dell'artista. By suggestion of the artist? Langdon was confused. It made no sense that Bernini had suggested his masterpiece be hidden in some obscure location. Langdon hesitated. Unless... He was fearful even to entertain the notion. Had Bernini perhaps suggested a remote church on a direct line with West Ponente's breath? As Langdon's excitement mounted, his vague familiarity with the actual statue intervened, insisting the work had nothing to do with fire. It depicted St. Teresa on her back in the throes of a toe-curling orgasm. hardly Vatican fare. Langdon hurriedly flipped to the ledger's description of the work. When he saw the sketch, he felt an instantaneous and unexpected tingle of hope. There was another figure in the statue, who Langdon had forgotten was there. An angel. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Even the type of angel Bernini had selected seemed significant. It's a seraphim, Langdon realized. Seraphim literally means the fiery one. Robert Langdon was not a man who had ever looked for confirmation from above. But when he read the name of the church where the sculpture now resided, he decided he might become a believer after all. Santa Maria della Vittoria. Vittoria, he thought, grinning. Perfect. Staggering to his feet, Langdon felt a rush of dizziness. He closed the book and left it neatly at the bottom of the nearest shelf. Unfortunately, his good fortune ran out before he reached the exit. Without warning, the vault let out a pained sigh. The lights dimmed, and the exit button went dead. Then, like an enormous expiring beast, the archival complex went totally black. Someone had just killed the power. The Holy Vatican Grottoes are located beneath the main floor of St. Peter's Basilica. They are the burial place of deceased popes. Vittoria reached the bottom of the spiral staircase and entered the grotto. Recessed in the alcoves, as far as the lights let them see, the hulking shadows of sarcophagi loomed. The flashlight procession moved on, and the papal silhouettes rose and fell against the walls, stretching and vanishing in a macabre shadowbox dance. The guards slowed now, as if unsure where exactly in the darkness the most recent pope was buried. The Camerlengo continued assuredly, and stopped before a marble tomb that seemed to glisten brighter than the others. Lying atop was a carved figure of the late pope. When Vittoria recognized his face from television, a shot of fear gripped her. What are we doing? I realize we do not have much time, the Camerlengo said. Please push the covering aside. The Swiss guards hesitated. Signore, one said, by law we are at your command. He paused. We will do as you say. There was a moment of silence, and then the lead guard gave the order. The three men set down their flashlights on the floor, and their shadows leapt overhead. Bracing their hands against the marble covering near the head of the tomb, they planted their feet and started pushing. Slowly the lid began to rotate off the top of the tomb. Everyone stepped back. Tentatively, a guard bent and retrieved his flashlight. Then he aimed it into the tomb. Vittoria had feared the corpse's mouth might be clenched tight with rigor mortis, and that she would have to suggest breaking the jaw to see the tongue. She now saw it would be unnecessary. The cheeks had collapsed, and the pope's mouth gaped wide. His tongue was black as death. No light, no sound. The secret archives were black. Fear, Langdon now realized, was an intense motivator. Short of breath, he fumbled through the blackness toward the revolving door. He found the button on the wall and rammed his palm against it. Nothing happened. He tried again. The door was dead. Now he remembered the walkie-talkie the guard had left on the table outside the vault. Why the hell didn't I bring it in? As regret receded, Langdon forced himself to think. You've been trapped before, he told himself. Think! Langdon lowered himself onto the floor. He rolled over on his back and laid his hands on his chest. The first step was to gain control. On his wrist, Mickey Mouse glowed happily, as if enjoying the dark. 9:33 p.m., half an hour until fire. But Langdon's mind, instead of coming up with a plan for escape, was suddenly demanding an explanation. Who turned off the power? Was Rocher expanding his search? Wouldn't Olivetti have warned Rocher that I'm in here? Opening his mouth wide and tipping back his head, Langdon pulled the deepest breaths he could manage. His head cleared.
He reeled his thoughts in and forced the gears into motion. Glass walls, he told himself, but damn thick glass. Suddenly he knew. He leaped to his feet and started pushing over stacks. Like enormous dominoes, the stacks began to topple one after another. Metal on metal, books tumbling everywhere. But the glass at the far end was thick. Suddenly he heard what he was waiting for, a different kind of collision. Far off, at the end of the vault, the sharp smack of metal on glass. Then there came a distant yielding, a ripple spidering outward through the glass. Suddenly, like a cannon, the glass exploded. With a great sucking hiss, the air gushed in. In the Vatican grottos, Vittoria was still standing before the late Pope's corpse when the electronic squawk of a walkie-talkie broke the silence. The voice blaring out sounded short of breath.
"This is Robert Langdon. Can anyone hear me?"
Vittoria looked up.
"Robert!"
She couldn't believe how much she suddenly wished he were here. The guards exchanged puzzled looks. One took a radio off his belt.
"Mr. Langdon, you are on Channel 3. The commander is waiting to hear from you on Channel 1.
"I know he's on Channel 1, damn it. I don't want to speak to him. I want the Camerlengo. Now. Somebody find him for me."
Still in the secret archives, Langdon stood amidst shattered glass and tried to catch his breath. He felt a warm liquid on his left hand and knew he was bleeding. The Camerlengo's voice spoke at once, startling Langdon.
"This is Camerlengo Ventresca. What's going on?"
Langdon pressed the button, his heart still pounding.
"I think somebody just tried to kill me."
There was silence on the line. Langdon tried to calm himself.
"I also know where the next killing is going to be."
The voice that came back was not the Camerlengo's. It was Commander Olivetti's.
"Mr. Langdon, do not speak another word."
Langdon's watch, now smeared with blood, read 9:41 p.m. as he ran across the courtyard of the Belvedere and approached the fountain outside the Swiss Guard security center. His hand had stopped bleeding and now felt worse than it looked. As he arrived, it seemed everyone convened at once. Olivetti, Rocher, the Camerlengo, Vittoria, and a handful of guards. Vittoria hurried toward him immediately.
"Robert, you're hurt."
Before Langdon could answer, Olivetti was before him.
"Mr. Langdon, I'm relieved you're okay. I'm sorry about the crossed signals in the archives."
"Crossed signals?" Langdon demanded. "You knew damn well."
"It was my fault,"
Rocher said, stepping forward, sounding contrite.
"I had no idea you were in the archives. Portions of our white zones are crosswired with that building. We were extending our search. I'm the one who killed Power. If I had known..."
"Robert,"
Vittoria said, taking his wounded hand in hers and looking it over.
"The Pope was poisoned. The Illuminati killed him."
Langdon heard the words, but they barely registered. He was saturated. All he could feel was the warmth of Vittoria's hands. The Camerlengo pulled a silk handkerchief from his cassock and handed it to Langdon so he could clean himself. The man said nothing. His green eyes seemed filled with a new fire.
"Robert," Vittoria pressed, "you said you found where the next cardinal is going to be killed?"
Langdon felt flighty.
"I do. It's at the..."
"No,"
Olivetti interrupted. "Mr. Langdon, when I asked you not to speak another word on the walkie-talkie, it was for a reason." He turned to the handful of assembled Swiss guards. "Excuse us, gentlemen." The soldiers disappeared into the security center. No indignity, only compliance. Olivetti turned back to the remaining group.
"As much as it pains me to say this, the murder of our Pope is an act that could only have been accomplished with help from within these walls. For the good of all, we can trust no one, including our guards."
He seemed to be suffering as he spoke the words. Rocher looked anxious.
"Inside collusion implies..."
"Yes," Olivetti said. "The integrity of your search is compromised.
And yet it is a gamble we must take. Keep looking.
Rocher looked like he was about to say something, thought better of it, and left. At the same time, a guard emerged from the security center and called out to the Camerlengo.
Signore, I just got word we have detained the BBC reporter, Mr. Glick.
The Camerlengo nodded.
Have both he and his camerawoman meet me outside the Sistine Chapel.
Even with its siren affixed and blaring, Olivetti's Alfa Romeo seemed to go unnoticed as it rocketed across the bridge into the heart of old Rome. Langdon sat in the back seat, Vittoria bandaging his hand with a first aid kit she'd found in the glove box. Olivetti never touched the brakes as he snaked the howling Alfa Romeo toward the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria. Overhead, the siren wailed. Nothing like telling him we're coming, Langdon thought. And yet they were making incredible time. He guessed Olivetti would kill the siren as they drew nearer. Now, with a moment to sit and reflect, Langdon felt a tinge of amazement as the news of the Pope's murder finally registered in his mind. The thought was inconceivable, and yet somehow it seemed a perfectly logical event. Infiltration had always been the Illuminati power base, rearrangements of power from within. The cellular in Vittoria's pocket rang. She answered, looking confused as to who might be calling her. Even from a few feet away, Langdon recognized the laser-like voice on the phone.
Vittoria, this is Maximilian Kohler. Have you found the antimatter yet?
Max, you're okay?
I saw the news. There was no mention of CERN or the antimatter. This is good. What is happening?
We haven't located the canister yet. The situation is complex. Right now we're headed...
Miss Vetra,
Olivetti interrupted.
You've said enough. You're on an open cellular line.
Vittoria took a deep breath.
Max?
I may have some information for you, Max said. About your father. I may know who he told about the antimatter.
Vittoria's expression clouded.
Max, my father said he told no one.
I'm afraid, Vittoria, your father did tell someone. I need to check some security records. I will be in touch soon.
The line went dead.
The church is on the Piazza Barberini, Olivetti said, killing the siren and checking his watch. We have 9 minutes.
A block from the piazza, Olivetti turned into an alley, gunned the car halfway down, and skidded to a stop. He pulled off his suit jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and loaded his weapon.
We can't risk your being recognized, he said. You two are on television. I want you across the piazza, out of sight, watching the front entrance. I'm going in the back.
He produced a familiar pistol and handed it to Langdon.
Just in case.
Langdon frowned. It was the second time today he had been handed the gun. He slid it into his breast pocket. As he did, he realized he was still carrying the folio from Diagramma. He couldn't believe he had forgotten to leave it behind. Olivetti got out of the car and motioned back up the alley.
The piazza is that way. Keep your eyes open and don't let yourselves be seen.
He cocked his weapon.
I'll be inside, waiting. This heathen is mine.
At that moment, very nearby, another cellular phone was ringing.
The Hashashin answered.
Speak.
It is I, the voice said. Janus.
The Hashashin smiled.
Hello, master.
Your position may be known. Someone is coming to stop you.
They are too late. I have already made the arrangements here.
Good. Make sure you escape alive. There is work yet to be done.
Langdon and Vittoria observed the Piazza Barberini from the shadows of a small alleyway on the western corner. The church was opposite them, a hazy cupola emerging from a faint cluster of buildings across the square. The night had brought with it a welcome cool,
and Langdon was surprised to find the square deserted. 5 of 10, Vittoria said, cat eyes darting around the square. No sooner had she spoken the words than she grabbed Langdon's arm and pulled him back into the shadows. She motioned to the center of the square. Langdon followed her gaze. When he saw it, he stiffened. Crossing in front of them, beneath a street lamp, two dark figures appeared. Both were cloaked, their heads covered with dark mantles, the traditional black covering of Catholic widows. Langdon would have guessed they were women, but he couldn't be sure in the dark. "Give me the gun," Vittoria said. "You can't just..." Fluid as a cat, Vittoria was in and out of his pocket once again. The gun glinted in her hand. Then, in absolute silence, as if her feet never touched the cobblestone, she was circling left in the shadows, arcing across the square to approach the couple from the rear. Langdon stood transfixed as Vittoria disappeared. Then, swearing to himself, he hurried after her.
"Mi scusi."
Vittoria's friendly tone lit the square like a torch. The figures turned, and Langdon exhaled in relief. Two elderly women stood before them, scowling out from beneath their mantles. One was so old she could barely stand. The other was helping her. Both clutched rosaries. They seemed confused by the sudden interruption. Vittoria smiled.
"Dove la chiesa?"
Where is the church? The two women motioned in unison to a bulky silhouette of a building on an inclined street from the direction they had come.
"E là."
"Grazie," Langdon said, coming forward, putting his hands on Vittoria's shoulders and gently pulling her back. He couldn't believe they'd almost attacked a pair of old ladies.
"Non si può entrare,"
one woman warned.
"Chiuso presto."
"Closed early?" Vittoria looked surprised.
"Perché?"
Apparently the women had been inside the church 15 minutes ago, praying for the Vatican in its time of need, when some man had appeared and told them the church was closing early. The man was a barbarobo, they explained, and he had forcibly made everyone inside leave.
"Barbarobo?" Langdon asked Vittoria. "A barbarian?"
Vittoria looked suddenly taut.
"Not quite. Barbarobo is derogatory wordplay. It means arabo. Arab."
Langdon felt a shiver and turned toward the outline of the church. As he did, his eyes glimpsed something in the church's stained glass windows. The image shot dread through his body. Unaware, Vittoria removed her cell phone and pressed the auto dial.
"I'm warning Olivetti."
Speechless, Langdon reached out and touched her arm. With a tremulous hand, he pointed to the church. Vittoria let out a gasp. Inside the building, glowing like evil eyes through the stained glass windows, shone the growing flash of flames. Langdon and Vittoria dashed to the main entrance of the church of Santa Maria della Vittoria and found the wooden door locked. Vittoria fired 3 shots from Olivetti's semi-automatic into the ancient bolt, and it shattered. The church had no anteroom, so the entirety of the sanctuary spread out in one gasping sweep as Langdon and Vittoria threw open the main door. Dead center of the sanctuary, beneath the main cupola, wooden pews had been stacked high and were now ablaze in some sort of epic funeral pyre. As Langdon's eyes followed the inferno upward, the true horror of the scene descended like a bird of prey. High overhead, from the left and right sides of the ceiling, hung 2 incensor cables, lines used for swinging frankincense vessels above the congregation. These lines, however, carried no incensers now, nor were they swinging. They had been used for something else. Suspended from the cables was a human being, a naked man. Each wrist had been connected to an opposing cable, and he had been hoisted almost to the point of being torn apart. His arms were outstretched in a spread eagle, as if he were nailed to some sort of invisible crucifix hovering within the house of God. Langdon felt paralyzed as he stared upward. The old man was alive, and he raised his head. A pair of terrified eyes gazed down in a silent plea for help. On the man's chest was a scorched emblem. He had been branded.
Langdon could not see it clearly, but he had little doubt what the marking said. As if ignited by some unseen force, Langdon felt his body suddenly in motion, dashing down the main aisle toward the conflagration. A few steps later, he was forced to stop. The fire was far too hot. Still in the rear of the church, Vittoria clutched the back of a pew, trying to gather her senses. After a minute, she moved forward to help Langdon, but as she did, a sound stopped her. The crackling of the flames was getting louder by the instant, but a second sound also cut the air, a metallic vibration, nearby. As she moved toward it, gun outstretched in her right hand, she realized she was also holding something in her left hand, her cell phone. In her panic, she had forgotten that outside she had used it to dial the commander, setting off his phone's silent vibration feature as a warning. Vittoria raised her phone to her ear. It was still ringing. The commander had never answered. Suddenly, with rising fear, Vittoria sensed she knew what was making the sound. She stepped forward, trembling. The entire church seemed to sink beneath her feet as her eyes met Olivetti's lifeless form on the floor. Vittoria fought the images of her own father's mangled body. The phone on the commander's belt lay against the floor, vibrating over and over against the cold marble. Vittoria hung up her own phone, and the ringing stopped. In the silence, Vittoria heard a new sound, a breathing in the dark directly behind her. She started to spin, gun raised, but she knew it was too late. "Now you are mine," a voice said. Then everything went black. Across the sanctuary, on the left lateral wall, Langdon balanced atop a pew and scraped upward on the wall, trying to reach the figure above. He thought, "Where the hell is Vittoria? Did she go for help? And where is Olivetti?" There was a howl of pain from above, and Langdon sensed he was already too late. "I need water, damn it!" he yelled out loud.
"That's next," a voice growled from the back of the church.
Langdon wheeled, almost falling off the pews. Striding up the side aisle directly toward him came a dark monster of a man. Langdon recognized the gun in his hand as the one from his own jacket pocket, the one Vittoria had been carrying when they came in. Realizing in a flash that the cardinal would die, that helping him now was impossible, Langdon reacted on instinct as the Hashashin's shot went off. Launching off the bench, he sailed arms first over the sea of church pews. Three ballotings. No pope. Inside the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortati had begun praying for a miracle. When the bolts on the outer door began to grind open, Mortati and the entire College of Cardinals wheeled in unison toward the entrance. They stared in incredulous shock at the man who walked in. For the first time in Vatican history, a Camerlengo had just crossed the sacred threshold of conclave after sealing the doors. The Camerlengo strode to the altar and turned to address the thunderstruck audience.
"Signore," he said, "I have waited as long as I can. There is something you have a right to know."
Langdon's elbows and knees burned as he clambered beneath the pews. His mind hunting for options, he scrambled blindly on. Footsteps closed fast to his right. When it happened, he was unprepared. He had guessed he had another 10 feet of pews until he reached the front of the church. He had guessed wrong. Without warning, the cover above him ran out. He froze for an instant, half exposed at the front of the church. Rising in the recess to his left, gargantuan from his vantage point, was the very thing that had brought him here. He had entirely forgotten. Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa rose up like some sort of pornographic still life. The saint on her back, arched in pleasure, mouth open in a moan, and over her, an angel pointing a spear of fire. A bullet exploded in the pew over Langdon's head. He felt his body rise like a sprinter out of a gate. Fueled only by adrenaline and barely conscious of his actions, he was suddenly running, hunched, head down, pounding across the front of the church to his right. As the bullets erupted behind him, Langdon dove yet again, sliding out of control across the marble floor, before crashing in a heap against the railing of a niche on the right-hand wall. It was then that he saw her, a crumpled heap near the back of the church.
Victoria!
Her bare legs were twisted beneath her, but Langdon sensed somehow that she was breathing. He had no time to help her. Immediately, the killer rounded the pews on the far left of the church and bore relentlessly down. Langdon knew in a heartbeat it was over. He did the only thing he could do, closing his eyes, slowing his breath to play dead, hoping it would work. The Hashashin, obviously in a hurry, seemed to buy it, dragging Langdon into a niche and dumping him there. Complete darkness and silence. As Langdon lay there, completely exhausted, he fought the closing darkness and turned his thoughts to her.
Victoria, are you alive?
If he had known the truth, the horror to which Victoria would soon awake, he would have wished, for her sake, that she were dead. Sitting in the Sistine Chapel among his stunned colleagues, Cardinal Mortati tried to comprehend the words he was hearing. Before him, lit only by the candlelight, the Camerlengo had just told a tale of such hatred and treachery that Mortati found himself trembling. The Camerlengo spoke of kidnapped cardinals, branded cardinals, murdered cardinals. He spoke of the ancient Illuminati, a name that dredged up forgotten fears, and of their resurgence and vow of revenge against the church. With pain in his voice, the Camerlengo spoke of his late pope, the victim of an Illuminati poisoning. And finally, his words almost a whisper, he spoke of a deadly new technology, antimatter, which in less than 2 hours threatened to destroy all of Vatican City. When he was through, it was as if Satan himself had sucked the air from the room. Nobody could move. The Camerlengo's words hung in the darkness. The only sound Mortati could now hear was the anomalous hum of a television camera in back, an electronic presence no conclave in history had ever endured, but a presence demanded by the Camerlengo. To the utter astonishment of the cardinals, the Camerlengo had entered the Sistine Chapel with two BBC reporters, a man and a woman, and announced that they would be transmitting his solemn statement live to the world. Now speaking directly to the camera, the Camerlengo stepped forward.
To the Illuminati, he said, his voice deepening, and to those of science, let me say this.
He paused.
You have won the war.
The silence spread now to the deepest corners of the chapel. Mortati could hear the desperate thumping of his own heart.
The wheels have been in motion for a long time, the Camerlengo said. Your victory has been inevitable. Never before has it been as obvious as it is at this moment. Science is the new god.
A rustle of confusion and bewilderment swept through the chapel.
But science's victory, the Camerlengo added, his voice intensifying, has cost every one of us. And it has cost us deeply.
Silence.
Science may have alleviated the miseries of disease and drudgery, and provided an array of gadgetry for our entertainment and convenience, but it has left us in a world without wonder. Does science hold anything sacred? It shatters God's world into smaller and smaller pieces in quest of meaning, and all it finds is more questions.
Mortati watched in awe. The Camerlengo was almost hypnotic now. He had a physical strength in his movements and voice that Mortati had never witnessed on a Vatican altar.
The ancient war between science and religion is over, the Camerlengo went on. You have won. But you have not won fairly. You have not won by providing answers.
You have won by so radically reorienting our society that the truths we once saw as signposts now seem inapplicable. We are a fractured and frantic species, moving down a path of destruction.
The Camerlengo paused a long moment, and then sharpened his eyes on the camera.
To science, I say this. The church is tired. We are exhausted from trying to be your signposts. If the outside world could see this church as I do, looking beyond the ritual of these walls, they would see a modern miracle, a brotherhood of imperfect, simple souls wanting only to be a voice of compassion in a world spinning out of control.
The Camerlengo motioned out over the College of Cardinals, and the BBC camerawoman instinctively followed, panning the crowd.
"Are we obsolete?" the Camerlengo asked. "Are these men dinosaurs? Am I? Does the world really need a voice for the poor, the weak, the oppressed, the unborn child? Do we really need souls like these who, though imperfect, spend their lives imploring each of us to read the signposts of morality and not lose our way?"
Mortati now realized that the Camerlengo, whether consciously or not, was making a brilliant move. By showing the cardinals, he was personalizing the church. Vatican City was no longer a building. It was people. People like the Camerlengo, who had spent their lives in the service of goodness.
"Tonight we are perched on a precipice," the Camerlengo said.
He lowered his voice to a whisper, and the camera moved in.
"The force, though mighty, is not invincible. Goodness can prevail. Listen to your hearts. Listen to God. Together we can step back from this abyss."
The Camerlengo knelt at the altar.
"Pray with me."
The College of Cardinals dropped to their knees to join him in prayer. Outside in St. Peter's Square and around the globe, a stunned world knelt with them. Inside the Vatican, Gunther Glick was walking on air as he followed the Camerlengo from the Sistine Chapel. Glick and Macri had just made the live transmission of the decade. Now, out on the hallway, the Camerlengo turned to Glick and Macri.
"I have asked the Swiss Guard to assemble photos for you. Photos of the branded cardinals, as well as one of his late holiness."
"Are you sure?"
Glick asked, trying to keep the excitement from his voice. The Camerlengo nodded.
"The Swiss Guard will also provide you a live video feed of the antimatter canister as it counts down."
Glick stared.
"Christmas. The Illuminati are about to find out," the Camerlengo declared, "that they have grossly overplayed their hand."
The Hashashin smiled as he pulled his van into the mammoth stone structure overlooking the Tiber River. He carried his prize up and up, spiraling higher in the stone tunnel, grateful his load was slender. Inside, he placed her on a plush divan. Then he expertly bound her arms behind her back and tied her feet. He knew that what he longed for would have to wait until his final task was finished. Water. Leaving his prize unconscious on the couch, the Hashashin went downstairs into a torchlit dungeon. The final task. He walked to the table and revered the sacred metal forms that had been left there for him. Water. It was his last. Removing a torch from the wall, as he had done three times already, he began heating the end. When the end of the object was white hot, he carried it to the cell. Inside, a single man stood in silence, old and alone.
"Cardinal Baja," the killer hissed, "have you prayed yet?"
The Italian's eyes were fearless.
only for your soul.
The six Pompieri firemen, who responded to the fire at the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria, extinguished the bonfire with blasts of halon gas. The execution in this church was something none of them would ever forget. Part crucifixion, part hanging, part burning at the stake, the scene was something dredged from a Gothic nightmare. Unfortunately, the press, as usual, had arrived before the fire department. They'd shot plenty of video before the Pompieri cleared the church. When the firemen finally cut the victim down and laid him on the floor, there was no doubt who the man was.
Cardinale Guidera, one whispered. Di Barcelona.
The chief of the firemen recognized the second victim immediately, the austere commander of the Swiss Guard. The chief called the Vatican, but all the circuits were busy. He knew it didn't matter. The Swiss Guard would hear about this on television in a matter of minutes. Then he saw Langdon on the floor, apparently alive.
Medico! He screamed. Medico!
Any word from Olivetti? The Camerlengo asked, looking drained as Rocher escorted him back from the Sistine Chapel to the Pope's office.
No, signore. I am fearing the worst.
When they reached the Pope's office, the Camerlengo's voice was heavy.
Captain, there is nothing more I can do here tonight. I do not wish to be disturbed. The rest is in God's hands. Yes, signore. The hour is late, Captain. At exactly 11:15 p.m., if the church is still in peril, I want you to evacuate the cardinals. I am putting their safety in your hands. Very good, signore. And you? Shall I come for you at 11:15 as well? There will be no need. I will leave when the spirit moves me.
As Rocher headed down the hall away from the Pope's office, a guard appeared running toward him. Even by candlelight, Rocher recognized Lieutenant Chartrand, young, green, and eager.
Captain!
Chartrand called, holding out a cellular phone.
I think the Camerlengo's address may have worked. We've got a caller here who says he has information that can help us. He phoned on one of the Vatican's private extensions. I have no idea how he got the number.
Rocher stopped.
What? He will only speak to the ranking officer.
Any word from Olivetti?
No, sir.
He took the receiver.
This is Captain Rocher. I am ranking officer here.
Rocher, the voice said, I will explain to you who I am. Then I will tell you what you are going to do next. When the caller stopped talking and hung up, Rocher stood stunned. He now knew from whom he was taking orders. At CERN, when the private line on the director's desk began to ring, Kohler's secretary, Sylvie Baudeloc, jumped. Nobody had that number. She answered,
Yes?
Miss Baudeloc, this is Director Kohler. Contact my pilot. My jet is to be ready in 5 minutes.
Langdon was still standing near the main altar with the fire chief and a few of his men. They had been rattling him with questions. Langdon wasn't listening. He had questions of his own. A fireman approached Langdon across the church.
I checked again, sir. The only bodies we found are Cardinal Guidera and the Swiss Guard commander. There's no sign of a woman here.
Grazie, Langdon said, unsure whether he was relieved or horrified.
He felt an unexpected emptiness inside. In Vittoria's absence, he felt something he had not felt in years. Loneliness. The pain gave him strength. Pushing all else from his mind, he mustered his concentration.
The last altar of science, Langdon thought.
The killer had one final task. Earth, air, fire, water. He looked at his watch. 30 minutes. Langdon moved past the fireman toward Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. This time, as he stared at Bernini's marker, Langdon had no doubt what he was looking for.
Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Directly over the recumbent saint, against a backdrop of gilded flame, hovered Bernini's angel. The angel's hand clutched a pointed spear of fire. Langdon's eyes followed the direction of the shaft, arcing toward the right side of the church. His eyes hit the wall. He scanned the spot where the spear was pointing. There was nothing there. Langdon knew, of course, the spear was pointing far beyond the wall, into the night, somewhere across Rome. "What direction is that?" Langdon asked, turning and addressing the fire chief with a newfound determination. "Direction?" The chief glanced where Langdon was pointing. He sounded confused.
"I don't know. West, I think."
Langdon frowned. "I need a city map, right away." The chief sent someone running out to the fire truck for a map. 2 minutes later, the man was back and handed Langdon the map. Langdon thanked him and spread it out on the altar. Surveying the whole of Rome, his eyes touched down on the three churches where the first three cardinals had been killed. The Chigi Chapel, St. Peter's, here. Seeing them all laid out before him now, Langdon noted an oddity in their locations. They seemed to be separated systematically in an enormous city-wide triangle.
"So where the hell is water?"
Langdon looked for a fourth point, a square, perhaps. Although a square made no symbolic sense, squares were symmetrical, at least. But then something unexpected happened. He noticed that the line he drew to indicate the direction of the angel's spear passed perfectly through one of the possibilities. Stupefied, he circled that point with a ballpoint pen he borrowed from the fireman. It lay dead center of Rome's famed Piazza Navona. Langdon knew the piazza contained a major church, but to the best of his knowledge, it contained no Bernini works. The church was called St. Agnes in Agony, named for St. Agnes, a ravishing teenage virgin banished to a life of sexual slavery for refusing to renounce her faith.
There must be something in that church.
The answer took another 30 seconds to hit him, but when it did, Langdon felt an exhilaration like nothing he had ever experienced in his academic career. The Illuminati genius, it seemed, would never cease.
Of course, the Illuminati believe in opposites.
Connecting opposite vertices of the locations with his pen, Langdon's fingers started trembling. There before him on the map was a giant cruciform.
It's a cross.
The four elements of science unfolded before his eyes, sprawled across Rome in an enormous city-wide cross. As he stared in wonder, a line of poetry rang in his mind, like an old friend with a new face. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. The fog began to clear. Langdon saw that the answer had been in front of him all night. The Illuminati poem had been telling him how the altars were laid out. A cross. The cruciform on the map, Langdon realized, was the ultimate Illuminati duality. Galileo's path of illumination was a tribute to both science and God. The rest of the puzzle fell into place almost immediately. Piazza Navona. Dead center of Piazza Navona, outside the Church of St. Agnes in Agony, Bernini had forged one of his most celebrated sculptures. Everyone who came to Rome went to see it. The Fountain of the Four Rivers. Water, Langdon thought. The final marker. It was perfect. Leaving at least one confused fireman in his wake, Langdon ran across the church in the direction of Olivetti's lifeless body. 10:31 p.m., he thought. Plenty of time. It was the first instant all day that Langdon felt ahead of the game. Kneeling beside Olivetti, out of sight behind some pews, Langdon discreetly took possession of the commander's semi-automatic and walkie-talkie. He then slipped out the door and skirted the press, who were now entering the church in droves. He crossed Piazza Barberini. In the shadows, he turned on the walkie-talkie. He tried to hail Vatican City, but heard nothing but static. Abruptly, he realized his plan to get help was not going to work. He spun, looking for a payphone. None. Vatican circuits were jammed anyway. He was alone.
Sensing options and minutes slipping away, Langdon made his decision. Pulling the gun from his pocket, he committed an act so out of character that he suspected his soul must now be possessed. Running over to a lone Citroen sedan idling at a stoplight, Langdon pointed the weapon through the driver's open window.
"40!" he yelled.
The trembling man got out. Langdon jumped behind the wheel and hit the gas. Gunther Glick sat on a bench in a holding tank inside the office of the Swiss Guard. Macri was beside him, looking a little bit stunned. Glick didn't blame her. He knew the conversation on which he had just reported was not intended for his ears. But this was his moment in the sun. Another Glick scoop.
"The 11th hour Samaritan,"
Macri groaned on the bench beside him, clearly unimpressed. Glick smiled. "Brilliant, wasn't it?"
"Brilliantly dumb."
"She's just jealous," Glick knew. Shortly after the Camerlengo's address, Glick had again, by chance, been in the right place at the right time. He'd overheard Rocher giving new orders to his men. Apparently, Rocher had received a phone call from a mysterious individual who Rocher claimed had critical information regarding the current crisis. Rocher was talking as if this man could help them, and was advising his guards to prepare for the guest's arrival. Although the information was clearly private, Glick had acted as any dedicated reporter would, without honor. He'd found a dark corner, ordered Macri to fire up a remote camera, and he'd reported the news. Nights in Rome, like those in the desert, can be surprisingly cool, even after a warm day. Langdon was huddled now on the fringes of Piazza Navona, pulling his jacket around him. He checked his watch. 15 minutes. He was grateful for a few moments of rest. The piazza was deserted. Bernini's masterful fountain sizzled before him with a fearful sorcery. The foaming pool sent a magical mist upward, lit from beneath by underwater floodlights. At 10:46 p.m., a black van emerged from the alleyway on the far side of the piazza. Langdon would not have given it a second look, except that the van drove with no headlights. Like a shark patrolling a moonlit bay, the vehicle circled the perimeter of the piazza. Langdon hunkered lower, crouched in the shadows beside the large stairway leading up to the Church of St. Agnes in Agony. He gazed out at the piazza, his pulse climbing. After making two complete circuits, the van banked inward toward Bernini's fountain. It pulled abreast of the basin, moving laterally along the rim until its side was flush with the fountain. Then it parked, its sliding door positioned only inches above the churning water. Mist billowed. Suddenly, the van's side door slid open. On the floor of the van, contorted in agony, lay a naked man. The man was wrapped in yards of heavy chains. He thrashed against the iron links, but the chains were too heavy. One of the links bisected the man's mouth like a horse's bit, stifling his cries for help. It was then that Langdon saw the second figure, moving around behind the prisoner in the dark, as though making final preparations. Langdon knew he had only seconds to act. Taking the gun, he slipped off his jacket and dropped it on the ground. Circling the perimeter of the fountain, he positioned himself directly opposite the van. Then he climbed over the rim and dropped into the foaming pool. The water was waist-deep and like ice. Langdon gritted his teeth and plowed through the water. The bottom was slippery, made doubly treacherous by a stratum of coins thrown for good luck. Langdon reached the interior of the fountain and circled back to his left. The van was only 15 feet away. Langdon raised his gun and stepped out of the mist, feeling like some sort of aquatic cowboy making a final stand.
"Don't move."
His voice was steadier than the gun. The Hashashin looked up. For a moment he seemed confused, as though he had seen a ghost. Then his lips curled into an evil smile. He raised his arms in submission.
"And so it goes.
Get out of the van. I won't hesitate to shoot."
"You've already hesitated,"
Langdon felt his finger tighten on the trigger. The Cardinal lay motionless now. He looked exhausted, moribund.
Untie him. Forget him. You've come for the woman. Do not pretend otherwise.
Langdon fought the urge to end it right there.
Where is she? Somewhere safe, awaiting my return.
From the darkness of the van, the Hashashin gazed out at his aggressor and couldn't help but feel an amused pity.
You fooled me at the church. You had the advantage here, the element of surprise, but you squandered it.
The American was indecisive, hoping for backup, most likely, or perhaps a slip of the tongue that would reveal critical information. The killer almost laughed aloud. Without breaking eye contact, he inched his hands across the ceiling of the van until he found what he was looking for. Staring dead ahead, he grasped it. Then he made his play. The motion was utterly unexpected. For an instant, Langdon thought the laws of physics had ceased to exist. The killer seemed to hang weightless in the air as his legs shot out from beneath him, his boots driving into the Cardinal's side and launching the chain-laden body out the door. The Cardinal splashed down, sending up a sheet of spray. Water dousing his face, Langdon realized too late what had happened. The killer had grasped one of the van's roll bars and used it to swing outward. Now the Hashashin was sailing toward him, feet first through the spray. Langdon pulled the trigger and the silencer spat. The bullet exploded through the toe of the Hashashin's left boot. Instantly, Langdon felt the soles of the Hashashin's boots connect with his chest, driving him back with a crushing kick. The two men splashed down in a spray of blood and water. As the icy liquid engulfed Langdon's body, his first cognition was pain. Survival instinct came next. He realized he was no longer holding his weapon. It had been knocked away. Diving deep, he groped along the slimy bottom. His hand gripped metal, but the object was stationary. Langdon suddenly realized that he had grasped part of the metal chain that was weighing the Cardinal down. As he stared, the chains across Baja's chest shifted, parting to reveal a further wickedness. A word stamped in the seared flesh. An instant later, two boots strode into view. One was gushing blood. Langdon broke the surface of the water and instinctively spun away. But he felt himself gripped around the shoulders, his attacker enjoying an advantage no water polo defenseman ever had, 2 feet on solid ground. Langdon felt himself going under. With crashing force, the Hashashin was on top of him, palms on his shoulders, all of his weight bearing down. Langdon's muscles burned as he twisted beneath the water. Everything blurred as the Hashashin drove him deeper still. It was then he saw it, poking out from under the coins directly beneath his face, a narrow black cylinder, the silencer of Olivetti's gun. Langdon reached out, but as his fingers wrapped around the cylinder, he did not feel metal. He felt plastic. When he pulled, the flexible rubber hose came flopping toward him like a flimsy snake. It was about 2 feet long, with a jet of bubbles surging from the end. Langdon had not found the gun at all. It was one of the fountain's many harmless bubble makers. The Hashashin ignored the burning in his foot and focused on the drowning American, whom he now held pinned beneath him in the churning water.
Finish it fully.
He tightened his grip, knowing this time Robert Langdon would not survive. As he predicted, his victim's struggling became weaker and weaker. Suddenly, Langdon's body went rigid. He began to shake wildly.
Yes, the Hashashin mused. The wriggles. When the water first hits the lungs.
The rigors, he knew, would last about 5 seconds. They lasted 6. The Hashashin held Langdon down for another 30 seconds to let the water flood all of his pulmonary tissue. Gradually, he felt Langdon's body sink on its own accord to the bottom. Finally, the Hashashin let go.
the media would find a double surprise in the Fountain of the Four Rivers.
Taban,
the Hashashin swore, clambering out of the fountain and looking at his bleeding toe. The tip of his boot was shredded, and the front of his big toe had been sheared off. Angry at his own carelessness, he tore the cuff from his pant leg and rammed the fabric into the toe of his boot. The bleeding slowed until it was only a trickle. Turning his thoughts from pain to pleasure, the Hashashin got into his van. His work in Rome was done. He knew exactly what would soothe his discomfort. Vittoria Vetra was bound and waiting. The Hashashin, even cold and wet, felt himself stiffen.
I have earned my reward.
Across town, Vittoria awoke in pain. She was on her back. When she tried to move, she felt spasms in her shoulders. It took her a moment to comprehend her hands were tied behind her back. Confusion transforming to fear, she scanned her surroundings. She was in a crude stone room, large and well-furnished, lit by torches, some kind of ancient meeting hall. Old-fashioned benches sat in a circle nearby. Vittoria felt a breeze, cold now on her skin. Nearby, a set of double doors stood open, beyond them a balcony. Through the slits in the balustrade, Vittoria could have sworn she saw the Vatican.